77 WABC. The following program is brought to you by NYU Winthrop Hospital. It's the weekend. Be good to yourself. It's Katz's Corner with Dr. Aaron Katz, where you get simple, straightforward answers to your questions about health, from diet and supplements to lifestyle changes. To reach Dr. Katz, call 800-848-WABC. Now, live on 77 WABC, it's the chairman of urology at NYU Winthrop Hospital in New York. Here is Dr. Aaron Katz.
Good morning, everyone. Not exactly Dr. Katz today. It's Dr. John Haas subbing for Dr. Katz, and I do want to wish him a big congratulations. He and our Department of Urology are at the American Urologic Association meeting in San Francisco. Dr. Katz and the team have 6 abstracts, and that's the largest urology meeting in the world. So kudos to Dr. Katz. We're very proud of him. He's spreading all the good work that we're doing at NYU Winthrop. Just a couple of brief announcements before I introduce our fantastic guest today. And we are live in the studio today, so please call 1-800-848-WABC. That's 800-848-9222. So NYU Winthrop Hospital is pleased to announce our flagship event for the year, the 2018 Men's Health Seminar, on Saturday, June 16th at the Garden City Hotel in Long Island. Our keynote speaker will be Dr. Michael Roizen. He's the Cleveland Clinic's Chief Wellness Officer and served as the first chair of the Wellness Institute. He's published a series of highly popular bestsellers, including 4 number one New York Times bestsellers translated to 44 languages. He and Dr. Oz write a daily column syndicated to 134 newspapers. He hosts a podcast. He's got an Emmy Award. We're going to have additional topics, controversies in prostate cancer treatments with Dr. Katz, myself, and Dr. Corcoran, causes and treatments of common urinary issues with Dr. Schiff. We'll have multiple breakout sessions like we've had in the past, management of rising PSA, digestive and colon health with Jules Garbus, the importance of sleep for men's health, treatments of ED and low testosterone with Brett Mellinger. Just a fantastic event. I've been doing this for the better part of 10 years, and please come to the Garden City Hotel. If you want to register online, it's www.menshealthseminar.com. And for any questions, please call 516-663-2316. So we're live in the studio. We're taking your phone calls at 848-WABC. That's 800-848-9222. So I have an absolutely fantastic guest with me today live in the studio. Dr. Alec Himmelman, in February of 2016, was named the Anita Steckler Chair and Professor and Chairman of Radiation Oncology at NYU Langone's Perlmutter Cancer Center. He received his BS from Cornell University, my alma mater, an MD and PhD from Mount Sinai, and a postdoctorate fellowship at the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute at the Harvard Medical School. He was an associate professor in the Department of Radiation Oncology at Harvard Medical School and its major teaching affiliates, the Dana-Farber Cancer Center and the Brigham and Women's Hospital, prior to coming to New York University. A major focus of Dr. Kimmelman's research is on pancreatic ductal adenocarcinoma metabolism. He and his lab have taken a really incredibly systematic approach in understanding how oncogenes, which we'll talk about, can alter the needs of these cancers. And this has really the opportunity to provide really novel therapeutic and diagnostic approaches to disease. So we're really going to open up the show today. Rather than, you know, specifically talk only about men's health cancer, we can talk about pancreatic cancer. Dr. Kimmelman's a radiation oncologist like myself, so feel free to call in. I've had the privilege of working with Dr. Kimmelman for the past several years, and I have not met a finer person than him to work with, and I now consider him to be a friend and a colleague. So, Alec, thank you for getting up with me this morning. How are you?
Thanks for having me, John. I'm well.
All right, so we're going to talk a little bit about what you do in addition to, you know, clinical radiation oncology. You know, we constantly hear the term translational research in cancer and oncology. What exactly is that, and how did you get involved with that during your career?
Sure. Simply put, in oncology, translational research is really the focus is to try and take things that we do in the laboratory and bring them back into the clinic. And vice versa, if we see something interesting into the clinic, to try and take that back into the laboratory to understand what's going on with the goal of bringing things back into the clinic. So it's really bridging the divide between the very basic research and the very clinical research to try and make discoveries that we can push things forward. How I got into it is my PhD was in an area of cancer biology, and when we started focusing on pancreas cancer later on, it's such an unmet need to really make some breakthroughs. So it's something that really fascinated me.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, you know, as a radiation oncologist, you know, I do you know, a lot of prostate cancer, but we see a fair amount of pancreatic cancer. And one of the things that's a little sometimes disheartening as a clinician, you know, our pancreatic cancer patients don't do quite as well as some of our other cancers, such as prostate cancer. Why do you think that is?
It's a great question. You know, I'd say we definitely are pushing the needle forward a bit. There was a period of time where we were making absolutely no progress, but now we do have some effective therapies in our armamentarium. But like you said, we do not have the same kind of successes in pancreas and prostate. You know, it's interesting. They're both adenocarcinomas, as you know, which is with the way the tumor looks under the microscope.
Right.
But one responds a lot better than the other. You know, some of it may be to do with the genetics. There are some certain genetic features in pancreas cancer that may make it more resistant. We think the microenvironment, sort of where the tumor grows, is an important part of the resistance. Pancreas cancer grows in this really unique microenvironment where it's surrounded by lots of other cell types in addition to the tumor cells themselves. And we think that may make it actually harder to treat as well.
And how come, you know, so we have a great screening mechanism for prostate cancer, which is the PSA blood test. And, you know, the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force, you know, changed their recommendations, you know, very recently. It's not quite where we'd like them to be, but a little bit more, you know, open as far as discussing screening, you know, with patients. Are there potential markers down the road or potential screening tests that could be done for pancreatic cancer as opposed to prostate?
So nothing really is advanced like PSA as you guys have for prostate. You know, part of it is there are some secreted markers that the tumors make. One of them is called CA19-9. It's really never really proven that useful to be a screening marker. It's not sensitive or specific enough. I mean, one of the fundamental issues is, though, even though pancreas cancer is soon to be the second leading cause of cancer death in patients, it's not quite as common, or it's not even close to as common as prostate cancer. So that makes it even more difficult to design a screening test. The test would basically have to be perfect, which is, as you know, very difficult. So people are working on it. There are high-risk families where several people may have pancreas cancer. So there's these people are trying to develop protocols to screen for them. People are looking at the blood, looking at things that are secreted to try and identify new markers. But nothing is really prime time yet. But there may be some stuff in the pipeline, hopefully, soon.
Yeah, so we're live in the studio. Feel free to call us, 800-848-WABC. That's 800-848-9222. Yeah, it's interesting. You know, prostate cancer, it's asymptomatic, and patients come with a blood test. And unfortunately, pancreatic cancer, at least the ones that I usually see, you know, come in a little bit later. They have back pain, you know, when a tumor is kind of invading back into the nerves and blood vessels called the celiac axis, or sometimes they get jaundice. And you know, every once in a while, I'll have a patient that'll do really, really well, which is gratifying. But for the most part, you know, again, it's something I'd like to see. And fortunately, people like you that are looking to kind of push the needle, as you said, to make things kind of go forward. So you know, if you don't mind, talk a little bit more specifically. You know, you gave a lecture to us at Winthrop not too long ago, which was fantastic, about your research in particular.
Oh, sure. Thanks. What we focus on is what we think is a really interesting problem, is that tumors in general, like pancreas cancer is a great example of this, you know, they grow sort of uncontrollably as opposed to normal tissue. So one of the situations that sets up is they have to make a significant amount of building blocks. They have to make nucleotides for their DNA. They have to make more cell membrane because they basically have to keep doubling themselves. So they have to rewire their metabolism in a way that supports that. And because pancreas cancers grow in that area that I talked about, that microenvironment that's really unique, it's really not really well perfused with blood vessels. There's not a lot of oxygen. There's basically not a lot of fuel sources. So they've come up with several very interesting ways to scavenge for food, essentially. They can take things from the outside of their tumor cells and bring it in and degrade it into food. What we focus a lot on is that they actually can eat themselves to an extent, to try and provide food sources to continue growing. And then basically their metabolic pathways are very different than normal cells. So you look at that as potential opportunity to target them therapeutically.
And do you see a time, or have you seen a time even now, where what's coming out of the lab can actually be used with patients that we're treating, you know, in year 2018?
So one of the things that we're pretty excited about is one of the pathways that we and others study is a pathway called autophagy, or self-eating. And pancreas cancers are a perfect example of this. They actually eat themselves, as I mentioned, to get fuel sources. We have some drugs that have been used in the clinic for decades, one of which is chloroquine, which is an anti-malarial. Another is hydroxychloroquine, which is a rheumatological drug. It's under the name Plaquenil. And they actually, one of the things that they do is inhibit this process. So we've produced a lot of preclinical data in the lab showing that you can treat models with these drugs and you see some interesting efficacious results. And now several groups are testing this in the clinic, in clinical trials, and there's been some promising early results that are released. So I certainly wouldn't do this not in the context of a clinical trial because it's important to make sure that it's being monitored for safety, but that's something that we're particularly excited about.
So a lot of times patients go to major cancer centers such as Perlmutter, such as, you know, the fantastic, you know, world-renowned cancer centers. When people are looking for trials, what should they look for? Let's say someone's newly diagnosed with pancreatic cancer as an example, and they're looking to see what's out there. How do they find out trials, and how do they find out what's available? Say it's something like Perlmutter, they just call, or the numbers to call, or how do they do their research?
So if they call the Pancreas Center at the Perlmutter Camp Pancreas Center, they'll get set up with a group of physicians who will know all of the national trials and be able to guide them through that. There are also resources that they can do even before. The Pancreatic Cancer Action Network is an organization that I've been involved with over the years, and they actually have a group of people staffing with a center that helps connect patients to clinical trials, even if they're not in their geographic area. So there are definitely resources. There are some trials that are coming online that we're particularly excited about. We're going to be opening a couple this year at Perlmutter Cancer Center that I think could actually be really game-changing in terms of how we treat the disease. So I think there's a lot of hope on the horizon that's been coming from science, but it always takes time.
And what are some of the other things? You know, we're talking about pancreatic cancer, but you run an enormous department, you know, of radiation oncologists and biologists and physicists. You know, what are some of the other things that are coming out of your department now that you're excited about?
There are a lot of technical advances, and you're very familiar with these as well, in terms of how we treat certain diseases to make them safer. I'm particularly excited about some of the work we've been doing in breast cancer, where, you know, for a long time we, avoided the heart, but we now know through lots of data from many, many women that the less you treat the heart with radiation during breast cancer treatment, the better the patient will be in the long term. So we've been working on a number of techniques and comparing them to try and really minimize heart dose. And the early data looks really exciting that we can really minimize heart and lung dose as well to really make the treatment a lot more safer.
Yeah, it's fantastic. I mean, you know, again, we brought some of the techniques from NYU Langone to NYU Winthrop. And again, we're live in the studio, so if you want to speak with Dr. Kimmelman about cancer, you want to speak with me about prostate cancer, men's health, we are live in the studio, 800-848-9222. But one of the things that came out of your department was actually, you know, when we historically treated radiation patients with breast cancer, again, one of the more common cancers that we see, we have patients lay on their back with their arm up, and especially with a left-sided breast cancer, you'll have, you know, again, the breast kind of sags over the left chest wall, and there is heart. And out of your institution, they started treating patients on their belly or supine, where the breast kind of hangs down, and that's really been a game changer. And I know, you know, your department was pioneering in that. One of the things that we started at Winthrop, and I know that you also have in the city, is doing what we call hypofractionated radiation. Can you talk a little bit about that?
So, you know, the standard course of radiation, as you know, for breast cancer is, you know, in the order of 5 to 6 weeks. And it was very effective. It has been studied in literally millions of women over many years. But over time, people wanted to understand, you know, because that's a pretty long commitment, as you know, to come in every day for 6 weeks. So they wanted to understand, is it effective and safe to try and decrease the time, basically giving a little bit more every day, but over a shorter time. And the data that's emerged from many institutions has been that you can actually do this safer over a shorter period, safely over a shorter period of time, something on the order of 3 to 4 weeks. And then, as you know, you guys are very active in this as well. There's even ways to treat smaller areas of the breasts for even shorter, for, you know, even 1 to 3 days kind of time frame. So these are studies that are ongoing and treatments that we're doing and you're doing that I think are really going to make a big difference.
Well, let's go to Jim. We have a caller. Jim from Manhattan has a question about the Whipple procedure. Jim, good morning. Thank you for calling in.
Oh, thanks. I'm sorry that I'm doing something slightly different than you're talking about now, but my brother-in-law had the Whipple procedure for his pancreas, I guess, about 11 or 12 years ago, and it was a big success, and he's fine right now, and I think that Winthrop has something also does the Whipple, but I'm not sure.
So we do. We have Dr. John Allendorf, who's absolutely fantastic. We recruited him from Columbia. He joined us several years ago, and he's at Winthrop. And it's fantastic that your brother was 12 years ago, 13 years ago, he had a Whipple procedure?
Brother-in-law, yeah. Dr. Brennan at Sloan Kettering, yeah.
That's great. Alan, could you tell us a little bit for the people that don't know what a Whipple procedure is?
Sure. So one of the tricky parts of pancreas cancer, and John talked about this in the beginning, is that it really is in a very precious area of real estate. There's a lot of things there. So, when it grows, it causes symptoms by growing into nerves or growing into blood vessels. A common place for the tumors to develop is in the head of the pancreas, which is just really what we call the beginning part of it. And the head of the pancreas is surrounded by small bowel, part of the small bowel called the duodenum. There's some ducts that take the bile and put them from the the biliary tract into the duodenum. So there's all these, it's an incredible anatomical area. So in order to remove that tumor, they have to do a very difficult procedure called a Whipple. And what they do is they resect the head of the pancreas, they take part of the small bowel, they reconstruct all of these ducts. It's essentially like an extreme, just to put it simply, and this is not, it is a very complicated procedure, but it's an extremely complicated plumbing procedure in that you have to reconnect everything then that you take out. So it's an incredible procedure. It takes a significant amount of time, but in great hands, like the surgeons that we're talking about now, it's done rather safely, and it can be effective in the treatment of early-stage disease.
Jim, was your brother diagnosed with pancreatic cancer?
That was brother-in-law.
Brother-in-law?
No, he was having other tests, and they just found out about it. He was very fortunate.
Well, that's fantastic. Again, it is a very involved procedure. I saw it done when I was in medical school and residency, but we do have a very robust pancreatic program both at NYU Winthrop and NYU Langone. We have Dr. John Allendorf at Winthrop, and I think, Alec, we just recruited someone from NYU Langone from Michigan, I think?
Yes, Diane Simeone. She's a fantastic surgeon scientist who heads our pancreas center. So we have her and a number of other surgeons who will do many of these. And I think one of the keys is to make sure you go to a place that has high volume like NYU Winthrop or NYU Langone, because in addition to the surgical experience, it's the postoperative care that's really important to make sure the patients do well and get through this. But, the scenario that the caller mentioned is something that's not super uncommon, which is that the patients who often we see who do well are the ones where it's discovered incidentally. So if someone who gets in a car accident ends up in the emergency room, gets a CAT scan, and they see something in the pancreas, or like you said, that they did some tests for something else and found something suspicious. So it goes back to what, John, you said about screening, which is that if we can get a test that's more effective in detecting early patients, we might be doing even better.
Yeah, it's interesting. We have our tumor boards every week at NYU Winthrop, as I'm sure they do at NYU Langone. And sometimes we'll see patients that have, instead of a pure pancreatic cancer, they have something called an ampullary cancer. And I've noticed anecdotally in my experience that sometimes the ampullary patients do better. Can you explain the difference between the two, or is there a difference between the two?
So it's interesting. They're definitely different tumors. The ampullary vada is one of those ducts that I talked about that allows the secretion of various digestive juices to flow. We often approach them the same, as you know, right, because it's almost an anatomy issue where they're right next to each other. But I think biologically we're learning that they definitely are different diseases. Like you said, there's subsets that do better. Now this brings up, I think, an even larger point, which is one of the movements in translational research, which you had asked me about earlier, is to really understand molecularly the tumors. So I think we're reaching a point, and we'll get to a point where instead of necessarily treating and calling a tumor by what it looks like under the microscope, we're going to do that by what it looks like genetically. So most large centers like NYU Winthrop, NYU Langone, Perlmutter Cancer Center, and others are now genomically characterizing patients who come in, their tumors, they sequence them.
Yeah, it's interesting. One of the things we see both for breast cancer and for pancreatic cancer, there's tests such as the Oncotype test or the Prolaris test. Are you familiar with that? And could you enlighten the listeners a little bit about those types of tests, how they work?
So Oncotype is a test where they send out the tumor after it's resected in breast cancer, and it gives you a score based on gene expression. And what you can do is they've managed to correlate that score with basically would a patient benefit from getting chemotherapy or not. And it's been really, watching that from my point of view has been really fascinating, because we used to use much sort of more basic ways to do it, as you probably remember, John, the size of the tumor, the age of the patient, whether lymph nodes, and those things are still important, but now we're actually adding molecular correlates to it. But I think we're even going to get further than that, where if you see a breast cancer that has a certain series of mutations, we may eventually treat that the same way that we treat a lung cancer that has the same matching series of mutations, because what's happening is people are designing drugs to target these specific mutations.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, you and I are contemporaries, and the way that we were historically trained is, you know, to stage patients 1, 2, 3, 4. And do you think, you know, as we become more advanced in cancer research, those staging systems are going to become archaic?
I think they're going to sort of stick around in one way or another, in that they will be modified substantially, but I think they're probably going to start to incorporate some of these genetics and genomics. So if you're a stage one that has this mutation and this mutation, you're very different than a stage one that has this mutation and this mutation. So I have a feeling, instead of the little things you and I had to memorize during our training, it's probably going to be this sort of three-dimensional chart that you're going to have to learn. But yeah, I think that's really where we're headed.
Yeah, it's interesting. And one of the things that, you know, constantly come up, we hear this term, you know, we're moving sort of, you know, just oncology in general, it's personalized medicine. And, you know, would you comment on that a little bit, Alec?
Yeah, and I think that's really where the field is largely going, and that's a perfect segue to what I was just mentioning, in that everyone's tumor is now going to be and is being characterized in a way that you'll know how their tumor is different than someone else's tumor. So one tumor may have this suite of changes and may require these kind of therapies, where a patient who has the same exact cancer type under the microscope will have a different series of changes, and that may be treated differently. So I think that's really where we're headed. You know, they're constantly making inhibitors to a lot of these mutations that are sort of allowed it to be more selective and targeted towards cancer and not the normal body. I think something we haven't really touched on is immunotherapy, which is an area that many people, including myself, are particularly excited about, where we can look at the tumor and basically develop an approach to try and have the body's own immune system attack it. And that's led to many successes in many different types of cancers.
Jim, do you have any further questions for Dr. Kimmelman? All right, so Jim left us. So go a little bit more, if you don't mind, Alec, into immunotherapy, because, again, that's something we're also talking about. And how does immunotherapy differ from targeted therapy? Are they the same thing? You know, all these terms that constantly come up at our tumor boards or our meetings, things like that.
So, you know, simply put, the immunotherapy is to, you know, and there are multiple ways that people do this, is to basically get the body's own immune system to target the tumor. And if you think about it, just in terms of disease, one of the most potent things that we have is our body's immune system. It fights infections. It's an incredible armamentarium that does everything from surveillance to attack to recruit more things to attack. So if you can get that to attack the cancer cells, that would be incredible. Now, one of the things that had been limiting that, and for good reason, is that tumor cells are your own body's cells. So they look a lot like your own body cells, except they've sort of gone awry. They grow, like I said, out of control. They lose some other properties. But in essence, they still are your own body's cells. So the immune system doesn't like to attack your own body cells, as you know, because that creates all sorts of autoimmune problems. So there's been some breakthroughs over the past, you know, 5 to 10 years that have allowed us to pharmacologically get the immune system to attack the tumor cells.
And how's that done?
So there's a lot of people probably hear this term. There's pharmacological agents that that are called checkpoint blockade, and they basically stop that step where the immune cell wouldn't want to attack the tumor cell because it sees it as self. So we have pharmacological ways to actually allow that to happen. Sort of bridging the two, you know, one of the things we're doing now is we're looking for neoantigens. So since tumors have all these mutations are things that the normal cells do not have. So they create what's called neoantigens. So there's a way to actually get the body's T cells, which are a type of immune cells, to actually hone in on these neoantigens and attack the tumor. So the thing about immune therapy that's amazing is that when it works, there's been cases that it's worked, you know, astoundingly well. You know, people who we thought were not even remotely curable, when we got the immune system involved, are actually cured. One of the things that we don't understand is how to see who are those people who are going to respond and who's not going to respond. So that's an area of active research.
Yeah, it's interesting. I was at a meeting last year at the Radiosurgery Society, and they had an entire section on immunotherapy. And one of the things that we historically have not done as radiation oncologists is use definitive radiation when someone has metastatic disease. You know, if someone has lung cancer or pancreatic cancer and they have a liver metastasis or multiple liver metastasis, you know, we historically have not done really high-dose radiation. But one of the new areas that they were explaining to us, and again, I recognize that I'm a neophyte or novice as far as immunotherapy and, you know, translational research, but using radiation to treat either a site of metastatic disease to kind of soup up or jumpstart the immune system. And is that something you think that's coming into the clinic now or may already be in the clinic?
Yeah, it's actually, it's a great segue because it fits exactly what I said. It's actually in the clinic. People are looking at this in a variety of clinical settings, but it's exactly based on, the theory is based on that whole concept of neoantigens, which is what you said. If you use a very high dose of radiation and kill part of someone's tumor, it releases, you know, for just being simple, like fragments of the tumor, and that can prime the immune system. So I actually think, like you're saying, this is an area that really has a lot of traction. It's being tested clinically in a variety of cancers, and it may help prime the immune system to attack the cancer.
Right. One of the things that, you know, that we were struggling with at these meetings is we don't quite know the doses. We don't quite know when to give the radiation. Is it integrated at the same time? And is that something that's being worked on as well?
Great question. We don't really understand, you know, do you want to give one high dose like you do with your stereotactics or your CyberKnife? Do you want to give a more protracted course? You know, do you want to do it before, during, or after you give checkpoint blockade? I think these are definitely clinically unresolved questions. People in the lab are starting to look at this in models of cancer to try and understand maybe we can work that out in the lab. There's some hints about certain doses and fractionation schemas of radiation that may be better, but we have to really study this rigorously in patients.
So we still have a few minutes left. Feel free to call us at 800-848-WABC. That's 800-848-WABC to speak with Dr. Kilman or myself. Alec, do you think there's going to be a time when conventional surgery, radiation, and chemotherapy are going to be replaced by some of these newer therapies?
You know, we always talk about this, as you know. I think it's really unlikely. I think what's really going to happen, I mean, if you think about it, most cancers around the world, and they've tracked this really well in the UK, are cured, you know, with surgery and or radiation. You know, they're the main curative modalities for cancer. And I don't think that's really going to change. Your best bet is either to, you know, for particularly localized disease, right, is to cut it out or use radiation to either as the primary way to get local control or adjuvantly when you have surgery. And I think what's going to happen is, like, you take immune therapy, for example, I think you're going to basically get a situation where you use surgery and radiation to get local control. You'll have targeted agents to try and get rid of as much distant disease as you can. And then you come in with the immune system to try and maintain durability, meaning you have this system that's going to be constantly monitoring for the emergence of new tumor cells. So I don't think it's going to ever go away. How we use it may change a little bit, but I think it's going to still be part of the armamentarium. Local control is still very important, as you know.
Yep. Last question I have for you. Do you think it's possible to identify cells before they turn malignant, to intervene preventatively like we do, say, for Gardasil for cervical cancer?
It is. It's difficult. You know, you can do it in, you know, very experimental systems. You can watch this. It's very difficult to do in areas where you don't have access. You know, the cervix is an area where you can do this nicely because you have a great test, like a pap smear or some other test, because it's very accessible. But, you know, it brings up the key point of prevention, which is you need to find the point in time when you can prevent it, right? If it's too early and it's something that's not likely to become cancer, then you don't want to do anything. And if it's too late, like the cat's already out of the bag, and you're not going to make an intervention. So finding that point is very important, because that's really where you're going to want to screen.
Yeah, it's that sweet spot. I did a year at the Lab of Cellular Oncology with Doug Lowy at NIH, and you know, out of that lab came Gardasil. And I remember, you know, that was kind of when that discovery came out, I was like, wow, maybe we can do this for some of the other cancers that we see commonly. And hopefully, you know, if we have an effective screener way to intervene even before cancer or cells become cancers, I think that's kind of the holy grail.
It's certainly the way they make the largest impact, for sure.
So, Alec, if people wanted to meet with you or anyone at the Department of Radiation Oncology at the Perlmutter Cancer Center, how would they get in touch with you or your department to come in for a consultation?
So all you have to do is call our department's main number. I will admit I'm remiss and don't have it at my fingertips right now, but it's certainly on our Perlmutter Cancer Center website and the NYU website. And we're very good about getting people in quickly, as you are. So,
Well, this has been an absolutely fantastic morning. You know, this really is the future of radiation oncology and oncology in general. So I'm so honored and thankful that Dr. Kilman woke up and joined us today. It was enlightening. So thank you so much for being with us, and hope you have a great weekend with a little bit of sun that may come out. We'll see you next week with Dr. Katz back at Katz's Corner.
WABC, New York.